Okay, well, we've already greeted each other, so we'll just go on from here. I want to read a passage of scripture from Deuteronomy chapter 30 and verse 19. Who knows where Deuteronomy is in the Bible?
The Old Testament.
Correct, the Old Testament. Or otherwise known as the Old Covenant. And the word covenant, of course, we talk about the Mayflower Compact today and a variety of things. I'm reading from the Geneva Bible again. Deuteronomy chapter 30, verse 19. I call heaven and earth to record this day against you, that I have set before you life and death, blessing and cursing. Therefore, choose life, that both thou and thy seed may live, by loving the Lord thy God, by obeying his voice, and by cleaving unto him. For he is thy life and the length of thy days, that thou mayest dwell in the land which the Lord sware unto thy fathers Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob to give them. Now the reason I chose to read that to you is because now I'm going to read to you what I mentioned earlier as the quintessential founding vision for America. And does anybody remember what we said quintessential was? Let's say quintessential, because you get two words there, quint and essential. If something is essential, you need to have it. Air is essential to our survival. Food and water are essential to our survival. Quintessential means the top aspects of essential. For we must consider that we shall be as a city upon a hill. The eyes of all people are upon us, so that if we shall deal falsely with our God in this work we have undertaken, and so cause him to withdraw his presence from us, we shall be made a story and a byword through the world. Beloved, there is now set before us life and good, death and evil, in that we are commanded this day to love the Lord our God and to love one another, to walk in his ways and keep his commandments and his ordinances and his laws and the articles of our covenant with him, that we may live and be multiplied, and that the Lord our God may bless. Therefore, let us choose life, that we and our seed may live by obeying his voice and cleaving to him, for he is our life and our prosperity. Now, today in America, are we following that quintessential vision? I'll give you a moment to think about that before I answer the question. No, we are not following this vision. Now think about this for a minute. A small group of people, 102, became this mighty nation of 330 million people. From a start, now if I told you that you were going to take 102 kernels of corn and you were going to plant it and you were going to end up harvesting 330 million ears of corn, that'd be a pretty good planting, wouldn't it? We grow corn around here, and this time of year we're harvesting it. We most all like to eat corn. That would be a tremendous harvest. Well, that's what happened while we were following the ways of the Lord, and it's very detailed, both in scriptures from the Old Testament or the Old Covenant, and the things that this was actually John Winthrop, who later became governor of the Plymouth Colony, he said that on the deck of the Arabella in 1630 in what was called the Great Migration. Many people came over in the Great Migration after Mayflower had gotten there and they had started to work the land and hunt and whatever else, and other people came following them, because it was easier for the ones that came after than the ones that went out before. It's the difference between being pioneers and being settlers. The pilgrims were pioneers. They settled an area, but they were pioneers. Besides the Mayflower Compact, which I gave out to you already, we have the Articles of Confederation of the United Colonies of New England, dated May 19, 1643, Anno Domini. As we determined, everyone knew that Anno Domini was Year of Our Lord. The reason I want to share a couple lines of this Articles of Confederation of the United Colonies of New England is because, once again, it emphasizes, now we're talking about 23 years later, after the Mayflower Compact, it emphasizes what their reason was. Whereas we all came into these parts of America with one and the same end and aim, namely, to advance the kingdom of our Lord Jesus Christ and to enjoy the liberties of the gospel in purity with peace, and whereas in our settling, by a wise providence of God, we are further dispersed upon the seacoasts and rivers than was at first intended, so that we cannot, according to our desire, with convenience communicate in one government and jurisdiction. And whereas we lived encompassed with people of several nations and strange languages, which hereafter may prove injurious to us or our posterity. I'm going to stop there and read further down. And a firm and perpetual league of friendship and amity for offense and defense, mutual advice and succor upon all just occasions, both for preserving and propagating the truth and liberties of the gospel and for their own mutual safety and welfare. Now that gives a description of why we have government. And of course you can go to Romans chapter 13 in the Bible and read what some of the reasons for government are and what government should and should not be doing. And by the way, government is not God. You know that. God gives us government, but government is not God. And governments that try to be God are called tyrannical and usually fail at that anyway, because only God can be God. It's interesting also, in the Plymouth Colony, they said that the Republican form of government, remember Republican when they were saying, was not a party, Republican or Democrat or Independent or Libertarian or whatever. Republican form of government was based on the consent of the governed. And that was in the Plymouth Constitution of 1636. So in other words, the people needed to consent to what was going on. And of course, we have elected representatives who are supposed to be doing the will of the people and, of course, the will of the Constitution. In Plymouth, on Atherton Street, how many of you have ever been there to Plymouth? Not a one of you. I hope, and I talked to your principal and said one day, perhaps it's a long way to go, expensive trip, but it would definitely be worth it at least to take the seniors down there, and maybe even younger ones as well. Because there on Atherton Street, which is actually 72 Atherton Street, or excuse me, I'm saying that wrong, Allerton Street, overlooking Plymouth Harbor, is the National Monument to the Forefathers, formerly known as the Pilgrim Monument. It commemorates the Mayflower Pilgrims. It was dedicated on August 1st, 1889. It honors their ideals as later generally embraced by the United States. It is thought to be the world's largest solid granite monument. Now, why would they do this in 1989, start that project? From 1620 till 1889, of course, that's after the War for Independence, the war between the states, it was determined that people had really forgotten the founding of our country and what the principles of the founding of our country was about. it was time to remind them. Now, some people would call that revisiting the true history. Some people might call it a revival, like churches have revivals. Why do they have revivals? To remind people that they need to stay on fire for the Lord and not cool off and die out. So located at 72 Allerton Street in Plymouth, Massachusetts, the 81-foot tall monument was commissioned by the Pilgrim Society. The original concept dates to around 1820, with actual planning beginning in 1850. The cornerstone was laid August 2nd, 1859. The monument was completed in October 1888 and was dedicated with appropriate ceremonies on August 1st, 1889. Now, the granite was quarried in Hallowell, Maine. Any of you have ever been to Hallowell, Maine? Maybe some of you are from there. Well, the granite that was used down there in Plymouth was quarried. In other words, they dug the granite out here in Hallowell, Maine, and transported it down there. The monument, which faces northeast of Plymouth Harbor and roughly towards Plymouth, England, sits in the center of a circular drive. It's actually a very beautiful park. You can go there and you can camp, not camp, but you can spend the day there. It's open from practically dawn to dark, and you can bring your dog on a leash, you could have a lunch there, and people do. It's beautiful sighting, and it's interesting that they face it towards seeing the harbor, and that faces towards Plymouth, England. On the main pedestal, and this is what's important, most important about it, is what's said on this monument that we really need to pay attention to. On the main pedestal stands the heroic figure of faith, with her right hand pointing towards heaven and her left hand clutching the, fill in the blank, clutching the Bible. Thank you. Upon the four buttresses also are seated figures, emblematic of the principles upon which the pilgrims founded their commonwealth. Now, the word commonwealth is an interesting word, isn't it? We have the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. We have the Commonwealth of Virginia. The idea of commonwealth, the idea that the wealth that is found is in common, and that was to be shared by everyone. And that's not what some people might call to be socialist or communistic, not at all. A sharing of the things that are there, I mean sharing of hunting and mining and whatever else. So they believed in that commonwealth, and of course that principle has changed very interestingly. And of course the Plymouth colony actually started to move north. In fact, Dover Point, which is in New Hampshire, is one of the oldest towns in New Hampshire, was founded by people from the Plymouth colony who got in their boats and started to row up or sail up the coastline and said, hey, look at this, there's a river coming in the Piscataway River. So they followed that and they went to a little island out there in Dover Point and found lots of oysters and clams and lobster and fur-bearing animals like beaver and whatever. So they said, hey, let's set up a colony here and we'll do business with Plymouth. We'll exchange what they have there for what we have here. So under the counterclockwise from the east are morality, law, education, and liberty. Can you imagine that? Morality, law, education, and liberty. All in one statement. Each was carved from a solid block of granite. Under morality stand prophet and evangelist. Under law stands justice and mercy. Under education are youth and wisdom. And under liberty stands tyranny, overthrown, and peace. On the face of the buttresses, beneath these figures, are high reliefs in marble, representing scenes from pilgrim history. Under morality is embarkation. Under law is treaty. Under education is compact. Under freedom is landing. Upon the four faces of the main pedestal are large panels for records. The front panel is inscribed as follows: National Monument to the Forefathers, erected by a grateful people in remembrance of their labors, sacrifices, and sufferings for the coming of civil and religious liberty. The rear panel, which was not engraved until recently, contains a quote from Governor William Bradford's famous history of Plymouth Plantation. Now, before I read that quote, please think about this. That what that inscription says, erected by a grateful people in remembrance of their labors, sacrifice, and suffering for the cause of civil and religious liberty. If we have any civil and religious liberty in this country, and believe me, as far as we have fallen in America, we still have a lot more than most countries of the world of the very things was stated there. Remember that. Your country, America, is the best country in the world, even though we have fallen short of what the original ideals were. We still have a lot of them in place. And of course, that there are some countries in this world you could not be in a Christian school. You could not be a Christian without being killed. That's happening all over the world today, in many countries of the world. So you have these things, and you didn't earn it. Somebody else earned it for you, and that's always a remembrance. What we have now that's good comes from the Lord. We didn't earn it. It's by God's grace. And our forefathers and foremothers, you know, because it was not only pilgrim fathers, but pilgrim mothers, that they bought for us, you might say, by their toils and troubles. And Governor Bradford shared this: thus, out of small beginnings, greater things have been produced by his hand, that made all things of nothing, and gives being to all things that are. And as one small candle light a thousand, so the light here kindled hath shone unto many, yea, in some sort to our whole nation. Let the glorious name of Jehovah have all praise. Now think about this. I always like candlelight service, like on Christmas Eve, and one person with a candle and a whole lot of other people that are standing there. You go over, the one person lights the candle of another person, they light the candle of another, and before long, that one candle that was lit up the whole place, all those candles. So the imagery that was used by Governor Bradford is very important here. As one small candle may light a thousand, so the light were kindled, shown unto many, yea, in some sort to our whole nation. Let the glorious name of Jehovah have all praise. I also want to remind you that many countries of the world have emulated or tried to repeat things of American Constitution and American freedom documents. I once met a pastor from Kenya, and he asked me if I would come to Kenya. And I said, why do you want me to come to Kenya? Well, we want the Patriot pastor to come and talk to us about the foundational documents like the Constitution, Declaration of American Independence, and so forth, in America. Because in Kenya, we have many Christians, but we don't have the government that we need to have. So you can see that many countries of the world look at us. Of course, the Republican government, like I mentioned, is grounded in the consent of the governed. And of course, we find that in Mayflower Compact, but the Plymouth Constitution of 1636, and talks about annual elections, term limits. Get this, this is interesting. That at the day and time appointed, a governor and seven assistants be chosen to rule and govern said plantations with the in the said limits for one whole year and no more. They had a one-year election cycle. And then they were out, and new people came in. What would that be like in America if we had that? Probably a pretty good idea, those term limitations. Because a lot of people get in there, and they stay in, and it's hard for them not to stay in there. Well, I'm going to open up to some questions here, because I think that you probably have some, and I would like to answer them, and feel free to do that. Feel free to ask. So go right ahead. Let's start off.
How big is the lower deck on the wind?
Well, I don't know the exact dimensions. I've been in it. I can tell you that I had to bend over like this at the waist all the way just to be there, so I couldn't have stood up in there. But of course, people in those days weren't very tall either. Some of the people were about 5'6". Nobody had size 14 feet like I do, smaller feet, and they actually would build fires right there because they had heavy beams on the decks. And one of the reasons why John Howland fell overboard that I mentioned and they had to retrieve him by a rope is because he was sick and didn't like being down below deck. So he came up on the deck and a wave in and washed him over the side. So not much space at all. And they had to sleep down there, and of course some of them slept in like a kind of a hammock. It was like a net. Very little space, and they didn't have any belongings. They didn't have room for them. But some of the stuff was stored way down below. So it was very difficult. I mean, cramped quarters. Like most of the time, you think about somebody going on an ocean liner that's huge, and you can walk around during the day, and you got a big suite to stay in. It wasn't like that at all. It was a very difficult situation. Good question. Others? Go ahead.
Did you have any way of protect their ship? Did they have like cannons or anything?
Say again?
Did they have any way to protect their ship? Did they have like cannons?
Oh, yes. In fact, I'm glad you asked that question. I forgot to bring that up. You know, today we talk about the Second Amendment as being part of the Bill of Rights in our Constitution. You know, the first 10 articles and so forth. Well, in the Plymouth Colony, if you came to church, and the first building that was built was the parish hall, and they used it for a lot of things. If you didn't bring your musket to church when you came to Sunday go to meeting, you were fined 25 shillings. It'd be like me saying to you, okay, on Sunday, when you come to church, if you're not armed, we're going to charge you $250. You're going to pay a fine of $250 because you don't have a gun. So they did have cannons, and actually the person who was in charge of the Mayflower, the military unit, was Miles Standish. He wore Spanish armor, like a Spanish helmet, and Spanish armor there, and he had muskets. He trained them how to, a lot of them weren't soldiers at all. I mean, so they had to have some training, almost like what they would say militia training, like in the Revolutionary War, War of American Independence. That's a very good question. It's not like, and they learned how to use bows and arrows from the Indians that they were friendly with. You have to go hunting and so forth, but of course even the Indians were glad to learn how to use muskets or blunderbuss. They had different type ones in those days. The blunderbuss was more like a shotgun kind of. So they have them, and flintlock pistols. Anybody know why it's called a flintlock? Because to fire it has a piece of flint, which is a very hard stone, and when flint hits metal, it makes a spark. And so they had powder, they had a powder horn, and they would measure a certain amount of powder and put it in the pan of the flintlock, and then they put the rest of it, along with a ball made of lead, into the musket and pack that down, and then the flash in the pan would go into a little hole in the musket. They weren't very accurate, and they were only good for up close, but people got pretty good at it. Well, they had to have powder, they had to have shot.
How far did they shoot?
Well, generally speaking, about 100 feet, but somebody was really good, and somebody, depending on what they had at one time, you know, they got a 44-inch barrel, and that's pretty heavy, pretty long, and they could actually put more powder in it to make the shot go further, and sometimes a couple hundred feet. That's about it. Not like today's rifles that, you know, can shoot for a long distance.
So
when
they were building their houses and things, did they come across Indians and they were like getting rid of something?
Oh, yeah. Well, the thing is, when the Plymouth colony was started, on the land it was started on, there were no Indians because there had been a plague of some sort, and the Indians that had been there were totally wiped out. But the neighboring Indians was a couple of tribes. One of them was the Wampanoags. The Wampanoags ended up being friendly with the Plymouth colony, and they actually had a 50-year peace treaty. It was broken by the Indians, not by the Plymouth colonists, but there was a very hostile, large tribe called the Narragansetts, which pretty much would be Narragansett area of Narragansett Bay in Rhode Island. And they were a big tribe, and they were wiping out other Indian tribes. And so the Wampanoags were very glad to have the support of the colonists with their firearms to protect them against the Narragansetts. So that was pretty interesting. That's a pretty good question to ask.
How did the Wampanoags end up?
Well, actually, in a war, it was called Prince Philip's War. Chief Massasoit, who is the person that they named Massachusetts after, Massachusetts is named after Chief Massasoit, who was Wampanoag sachem, they called him. He was dying. And Elder Brewster, who was in the colony, was also a doctor, went over to treat him with herbs and whatever else. And he got better. He sat up in his bed and he said, "By this I know you love me." And so they made a treaty, and it lasted for 50 years. And in the treaty, if any Indian broke the law, the Indians took them and tried them. Many of them were hung by Indians themselves. Or if any of the colonists broke the treaty in any way, then they were taken and tried or hung and punished by the colonists. The war was called King Philip's War. King Philip was actually the grandson of Massasoit, and he broke the treaty. And actually his own tribe caught up with him, because, you know, some of the tribe went with him and caused lots of mayhem and killed a lot of people, whatever. His own tribe went and caught him, and they hung him because he broke the treaty. And that's very unique, because the story that's being told, how the Pilgrims drove the Native Americans away and didn't have a good relationship with them, and all this kind of stuff, is not true. A lot of these things, as I said earlier today, a lot of things are called revisionist history. People today go back and want to change the historical account to fit what they believe today. Good questions. Keep them up. I like answering questions. It's good for the brain.
Good day, Father. The other day in class, I was reading to them about a little bit of the Plymouth Plantation book. I read about the part where the water went up to their like ears and neck, and they were crying out, "The Lord can still save." There was a comment where like the water actually got into the ship. Were those ships intended for the ocean? Or?
Well, they were, but those were commercial ships. They weren't passenger ships. They were actually passengers on a freight liner, so to speak. And of course, they had pumping devices to pump the water, because most all of them leak, because what happens is the wood would shrink and there'd be leaks. And of course, if any damage was done trying to patch it, they use sailcloth, and a lot of times they would use tar or pitch, you know, lather it on there, and they'd try to put that pitch in between the gaps in the wood that would leak. But none of them were the best of ships, because they didn't even know if that was going to make it in the first place. They didn't know if it was going to come back, and that's all that they could afford to go on. They might have been better ships, but that's all they could afford, the passage. And of course, they owed money, and this is a good question you're asking, because in the first couple of years of the colony, they had basically what they understood to be having all things in common, which turned out to be almost like the idea of socialism. And it didn't work, because what happened is they had bills to pay. They owed people back in England for their passage, and they were supposed to ship out a certain amount of corn and skins, you know, beaver skins and fur-bearing animal skins, and it wasn't happening. And they were supposed to be planting crops, because a lot of the young men, particularly the young men, said, hey, I'm not going to get up, it's a cold day, I'm not going to go out there. And so basically the adage was, hey, you don't work, you don't eat. That's a biblical passage. But also they said, you know, the thing is, if you, your failure to plan does not constitute an emergency on our part, if you don't go out and work, then you're going to be hungry in winter, and we're not under obligation to feed you. If you've been sick, that's a different story. If you're unable, that's a different story. If you're too old, a lot of the young men said, hey, I'm not going to go out and work like that, you know, so somebody else gets the benefit of my work. And so what they did is the elders came together in the colony and said, this isn't working. We're not paying our bills, and they're asking us for money from England. We can't buy any new goods. We can't get anything transported over here, because they won't transport it, because we owe them money. So they decided to give everybody their own plot of land. Okay, this is your 5 acres, this is your 5 acres. If you don't work it and you don't plant it, then you won't have a harvest. And you know what happened? After that, they had a bumper crop of everything. And they were able to pay off their bills within 3 years, paid all their bills off, and had a profit. So in other words, that was the first incident of capitalism overcoming socialism in a sense.
When they were first leaving England, and they had the speedway with them too, how big, when it, when it was broken, how big was the hole?
Well, I don't know that it actually had a hole in it. I just believe that it was leaking very badly from what we were talking about, the cracks on the boat between the siding like that. It was just so big a gap, they just couldn't stop it. Plus, I believe also that they had trouble with the mast on there breaking. It's interesting, too, because during the War for American Independence, the King of England reserved, before that, they stamped trees for masts. Even if the tree was on your land, it was stamped with the king's stamp. You couldn't cut that tree down or they'd hang you. In New Hampshire, we had what was called a pine tree riot, because the king was taking all the best logs for the masts of his sailing ships, and the colonials couldn't have the good logs for building houses or building their own ships. So there are a lot of things in the old days. I mean, the idea of sailcloth and good cloth, all those kind of things. So Speedwell and the people there, as I said earlier, they decided this can't be God's will for us, so we're going to turn back. And everything we've got, they sold their stuff. They gave money to help the Mayflower people, because the passage was very expensive. They charged them a lot of money. In a sense, they price gouged them. Charge them way too much. But that was the only hope they had of getting out of there. There's another hand went up over here.
Did they bring any animals with them on the Mayflower?
Yeah, they brought some. They brought chickens and some pigs and things like that, basic. They actually brought some cornmeal and things like that, but of course the problem was, because remember on the voyage, it was not only the Mayflower passengers of 102 passengers, it was also the sailors themselves and the captain, Captain Jones, who was not a pilgrim, he wasn't a Puritan. In fact, he didn't even like them and spoke ill of them and so forth. He was more of a monarchist and more of what would be called an Episcopalian. And he just thought they were crazy people and didn't have anything good to say, but he was hired to take them. And so they brought stuff, but their, a lot of their cornmeal and everything in barrels got spoiled, and the maggots in there and everything else. So, I mean, they had to, when they got there, the food was pretty much gone. And they had to start all over again. And because they had, like I said, a few farm animals, like I guess some geese, some chickens, and some pigs.
How did the captain get back to him?
He actually stayed on the ship. He never went on land. He stayed with his crew on the ship. And in the spring, the contract they had was by spring they were supposed to be settled, and anything that they were going to ship back to England was going to go back, and he left in the spring. So, because remember when he got there, it was the middle of winter. And so the idea of having to fix the ship, which he did, and sail back in the spring when the weather wasn't so bad, was what they did. And of course he did bring some things back with him that were taken, like skins or whatever.
How far did the speedwagon hit before they
used to get it? Say that again?
How far did the speedwagon make it before they used to
get it? I believe it was about 50 miles, 100 miles offshore, not very far at all. And they just realized that this is not a good idea. Okay, any other questions?